You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Michelle Lute and Chris Smith. They are both with Wild Earth Guardians, and they're here to talk to us about wildlife in New Mexico and in the nation, how wild species are managed by the agencies responsible for them, what's working, what isn't. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So you have been working, Wild Earth Guardians has been working on examining an agency of our government, our national government, called Wildlife Services. And according to their materials, they seem to be all about controlling overpopulated wildlife species and invasive species. And yet you've written a report on their work that says that they kill many species that are not, you know, even if they're not endangered, or at least certainly not overpopulated. And there's a lot of problems with that agency. What's going on?
Well, Wildlife Services, first of all, has a very confusing name. Wildlife Services doesn't serve wildlife, and they don't serve people recreating on public lands. Wildlife Services is an archaic institution that has been reticent to show any sort of change, and they basically go through and kill our native wildlife species across landscapes. They aerially gun coyotes across landscapes, despite the fact that modern science shows that that is not effective. As the old saying goes, kill one coyote and two shows up to his or her funeral.
Is that true? So if you kill one, they just...
Yes. So anthropogenic mortality, lots of people killing coyotes across the landscape, results in a really adaptive approach from coyotes. They start sexual maturity earlier, at earlier ages, and they have larger litter sizes. So they produce more pups. And this killing creates a lot of chaos across the landscape in their social structures. So we've got fragmenting. So they're very adaptive. They can respond to this mortality with more births, but it's chaotic and you don't have stable families, basically, when this is happening, when Wildlife Services is going in and using their lethal arsenal of poisons, traps, snares, aerial gunning. You name it.
It's a lot of different kinds of killing, and they kill, I mean, according to your report, they kill a lot of different kinds of animals, but some of the animals they kill are cougars, gray wolves, black bears, bobcats, gray foxes, red foxes, tens of thousands of coyotes, and even one critically endangered wolf, Mexican wolf. What is the rationale for killing all these animals? I mean, they seem to be, the ones that I've read, there are many more also, are predator species.
What is the rationale? That's a great question. It's a sort of archaic idea that ranchers can have the number one use of any sort of land and that we shouldn't share it with wildlife. I guess that's how I would sum up the rationale. They want to protect livestock, and they're doing it in these old methods that don't actually result in protecting livestock.
So it's really all about livestock?
A lot of it is driven by livestock. So even when you see the numbers of red-winged blackbirds that are in the tens of thousands that they kill every year, that's to protect various foods that red-winged blackbirds might eat. But that is the number one target, or the reason that native wildlife are targeted by Wildlife Services.
When you say foods that red-winged blackbirds might eat, they're not eating cows.
No, they're not eating cows, but they're eating other plant species. So nuts and berries and that sort of thing that might be growing. In New Mexico, there's a lot of pecan farms that are targeted by birds. And so the easiest thing to do is to put out poisons to kill all kinds of birds.
Now, you've named some of the ways in which this killing is done. Let's talk about that in some more detail. There's aerial killing where they shoot animals with guns from helicopters. What else?
There's traps and snares, which Chris can talk about at more length. But another tool that we're focusing on trying to take out of Wildlife Services' lethal toolbox is poisons, in particular M44 sodium cyanide bombs. So these are innocuous-looking little sprinkler heads that are basically a bomb. They're baited with stinky bait that attracts canids like coyotes. They're put out on our public and private lands, and they sometimes attract people's companion animals. But they have a poison that when the animal bites the bait, the stinky bait that they're attracted to, a powder is detonated into their mouth, and then when it mixes with saliva, it turns into a gas, and then it slowly deprives all the cells in the body of oxygen. So the animal dies within several minutes, a slow, excruciating death where they're essentially losing all the oxygen in their body and suffocating from the inside out. I sound like such a Debbie Downer talking about these details, but it's a terrible thing, and it happens to our native wildlife. It happens to people's dogs when they're recreating on public lands.
Yeah, there was a story about a child in Idaho who was out with his dog, and it was actually the kid who picked up the little bomb thing, and it's quite extraordinary that that kid survived without any major damage, but his dog died immediately.
He watched his dog die, and then he suffered from headaches and nausea for several months afterwards.
Yeah.
And the family has been motivated to start lobbying against these terrible devices, and so that's drawn a lot of attention, and we even have a rep from Oregon, Pete DeFazio, who's introduced a bill to ban M44 sodium cyanide bombs and compound 1080, another poison that Wildlife Services uses.
What are the ecological effects of all of these? I mean, when you shoot bullets, then there are these lead bullets.
Mm-hmm.
When you set off cyanide bombs, there's cyanide-laced carcasses that mm-hmm. presumably other creatures are going to feed on. Do we know?
That's a great question. So sodium cyanide in particular doesn't have the secondary poisoning effects that are as bad as, say, strychnine. Strychnine has been used before sodium cyanide to kill wildlife, and they do have really terrible secondary poisoning where a carcass gets eaten by lots of different carnivores, and then that killing spreads across the landscape. But still, the killing of native wildlife, you know, as I mentioned, the example with coyotes, clearly affects family pack structures, but it also, in other species, it affects populations on a broad level and not to the benefit of ecosystems or biodiversity or any sort of stability in the landscape.
Now, does this agency, Wildlife Services, do they follow the rule, for example, do they follow the National Environmental Policy Act?
Only when we sue them to make them do so. They've been shown time and again to not follow federal law or their own rules. So again, for instance, with this M44 sodium cyanide bomb issue, after the incident, the tragedy really in Pocatello happened, we petitioned them and they took all of their devices off Idaho lands. But the one that exposed the boy in Pocatello wasn't supposed to be where it was at anyways. So they've already been shown to not follow their own rules. And their response to the Pocatello tragedy was, we'll make more rules. We'll put up more signs. We'll put them closer to these devices. But there have been decades of proof that they don't follow those rules. So they're really just very flippant about public safety.
Is there an enforcement mechanism besides nonprofit organizations filing lawsuits?
That's a great question. I would like to think so, but this organization, this institution has been so reticent to change that really heavy-handed lawsuits and the reform that we're doing on the ground in a number of local places is what we've identified as some of the best tools. But citizens speaking out against this, being informed about what Wildlife Services is doing, and then speaking to their legislators is another really important avenue to create change.
The practices of land management and the science behind land management have shifted a lot in the last century. What does science say now about predators in wild places, and to what extent has land use, land management policy caught up with the science?
Science now is showing that carnivores have a number of ecosystem benefits that they provide. Increasing biodiversity in a number of places. We've seen that. The famous example is the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone and what they call trophic cascades, these cascading positive effects that happen throughout the ecosystem. So that's something that science is showing.
Trophic cascades referring to basically food webs or food chains.
Essentially, yes. Yeah, yeah. So wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone. They changed the behavior and population dynamics of the elk, who had no fear of predators in the area. So they were over-browsing riparian areas along rivers and decreasing habitat for songbirds and beavers and all kinds of things. So wolves coming in balance coyote population, balance the elk population, and that has cascading effects across a number of species and the habitats that they share. So that's just one instance of modern science showing all of the benefits that carnivores have in a number of places. And you asked, has land management caught up with the modern science? And there are definitely examples where it has. There's progressive communities creating their own policies to coexist with wildlife, and particularly native carnivores. So there's some examples in Montana and Idaho, really good progressive land management practices. But by and large, our state agencies and even our federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been reticent to take on the newest science and be progressive in their wildlife policies.
One of the things about this Wildlife Services agency that you report on in your report is that they're not really keeping records. You cite a shoot, shovel, and shut up mentality. So The numbers that you have about the death toll of these various animals that are killed might be a little bit low, might be very low. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. What does that look like when you try to get data?
It's really difficult. So we've had to use the Freedom of Information Act to request public records to get some of this information. And in the counties where I work on the ground, it takes a lot of tracking down the right individuals to find any sort of reporting that Wildlife Services does to the county governments that they contract with. And we know from former Wildlife Service employees that they've been told to underrepresent any of the sort of unintentional, I put in air quotes, accidental take of wildlife. So if they accidentally catch an endangered species or threatened species, they're often told to, as you mentioned, shoot, shovel, and shut up. And so we know that they're not reporting those numbers anywhere near accurately.
Yeah, I mean, one of the former employees of that agency was basically saying, look, they're all about plausible deniability and just keeping that information secret, which has also got to be illegal.
Yes, and that's why we win lawsuits when we bring them to court to make them answer for their actions.
There's another piece of it, which is culture. I mean, if that's the culture of the agency, how do you address that, or how do you see that being addressed in the long run?
Well, leadership has to change. Leadership has been shown to really be archaic and not adopting the best available science. So as positions open up, we need more progressive, open-minded people taking those positions. But that's very slow going, and that's why we're trying to reform the agency from the bottom up, working on the county level to get counties to cancel their contracts with Wildlife Services and end these longstanding relationships and replace those contracts with plans that promote coexistence between people and wildlife.
How's that going?
It's slow, but it's going. It's relationship building on the ground. And once we start talking to the public and we talk to county commissioners who don't even realize that the county contracts with Wildlife Services, we're finding that there's a lot of support on the ground for changing these practices. A lot of people just don't know that it's even happening in their backyard.
Yeah. Do you see a legitimate purpose for a wildlife control agency?
Short answer is no. Wildlife have existed on these landscapes for a lot longer than we've been around trying to intervene. So the whole notion that humans need to come in and dial one species up because we like them and dial another species down because they're inconvenient, I think is just an old idea that needs to die very quickly. It's not effective. It's a waste of public resources, and it's unnecessary. Wildlife regulate themselves unless humans are coming in and mucking up the system.
Well, which has happened, because Lord knows there's many non-native species, there are invasive species, there's feral pigs, feral hogs, which wreak havoc with people that really shouldn't be there in the first place. And there are wildlife situations that are a direct result of exactly what you said, humans mucking up the system.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think the only human intervention is needed is to mitigate the negative effects that we've already had on systems.
What kinds of methods? I mean, let's say we agree that you do really need to control feral pigs. Mm-hmm. What methods do you advocate for that kind of wildlife control?
That's a good but tough question. Right now, feral pigs and invasive species are typically targeted with a lot of the lethal tools that we claim are cruel, and they are cruel. So, you know, and some of my background is in ethics. So I look at that question and I think about, well, if we imply intrinsic value, if we apply intrinsic value, which is the value of an entity to exist beyond its use to anybody else. So if we say wolves have intrinsic value, we can't say that feral pigs don't unless we have a good reason for that. And I haven't heard of a good reason. So when you ask folks how they apply intrinsic value, they say, a lot of folks say all life has intrinsic value, as do ecosystems in their fully functioning forms. So I think we have to answer that question just by digging into, okay, if feral pigs have intrinsic value, if we're ascribing intrinsic value to them, you know, what rights do they have to exist, and when is it a good reason to kill them? So some people might conclude that the most humane methods of killing feral pigs is appropriate. Other folks will not. And so that's where ethicists come in and can help us navigate these really difficult questions around what is right and wrong treatment of animals. And that's, I think, a place where there's a lot more work to be done in terms of thinking.
I mean, if you take that to its extreme, I shouldn't call the exterminator when my kitchen is overrun with ants.
Right. But there can be reasons to take life. So if there's a species spreading disease, you can make an argument that you have to protect other life. And so, you know, those things balance out, and you have to kind of just ask these questions in a very specific context. Is this right in this case? And I, you know, that's might make some people uncomfortable or seem impractical, but I think it's good to start having these conversations around when it's right or wrong. And I think right now we're at this place where we just kill animals that are inconvenient to us, and I think we need to start questioning that.
It's funny, I heard a story once about a very distinguished Buddhist meditation teacher was starting a center, and they were building the center, and they found scorpions. And they were like, well, we can't take a life, what are we supposed to do? And he said, kill every last one, because we are here to have a meditation center, and nobody will be able to find enlightenment or anything else if they're being bitten by scorpions.
Sure.
And I just thought that was, I mean, like, here we have a Buddhist teacher mm-hmm. who's thought about this more than most of us.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
saying this. So it's an yeah. interesting question. One of the things that I was thinking about when I was looking at this Wildlife Services, of course, they, you know, their website makes a good case for overpopulated animals and non-native species and so on. And, you know, it's something we could talk about for a long time. Mm-hmm. But what really struck me was, I mean, there are agencies devoted to killing wildlife and agencies devoted to saving wildlife. Do they talk to each other?
It seems not. And that might happen sometimes. But yeah, there's definitely the left hand and the right hand don't necessarily know what they're doing. And sometimes they're working against each other and wasting public resources in the process.
How active is Wildlife Services here in New Mexico?
They're very active. They're working in the majority of counties across New Mexico.
And what are they doing?
That's another good question. Based on the information that we're tracking down, it does seem that coyotes are a pretty big target of Wildlife Services in New Mexico, but they're killing all kinds of native carnivore species.
One of the things that you were talking about, Michelle, is trapping. And Chris Smith, you've been working a lot on the whole question of trapping, and especially wildlife trapping here in New Mexico. What does that look like? What are we talking about?
Well, Wild Earth Guardians and a number of our ally activists and ally groups are working to bring trapping policy in New Mexico to the 21st century rather than the 19th century where it's stuck. Currently, in New Mexico, trapping is basically unregulated, and we think that it is an immense risk to public safety. It's inherently indiscriminate and can harm native wildlife populations. It's cruel, and it's the private commodification of a public trust resource.
And so you have, when you say it's like a holdover from the 19th century, what did trapping look like at that point?
Well, you know, a lot of I'll call them entrepreneurs for lack of a better word, but a lot of people came to the West to trap both for fur and pelts, but also to kind of clear the way for our agricultural complex, it was seen as this way to kind of make the land ready for what was to come. And I think since then we've recognized, as Michelle alluded to, the inherent value of wildlife and the ecosystem functions that wildlife serves. And we need to now reflect that in our policies in this state where we manage wildlife.
What kinds of animals are being trapped in New Mexico, and in what kind of numbers?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the most common targeted animals by trappers are bobcats and coyotes, badgers, weasels, foxes, raccoons to an extent. And on average, there's somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 bobcats taken per year in the state. Coyotes, which I think is the other creature that we're especially focused on, coyotes aren't actually regulated by the state in any legal terms, so we have no idea how many coyotes are being taken by trappers. There's no reporting requirements for coyotes. But we're seeing the loss of thousands of native wildlife lives every year in the state.
What do they do with these animals when they trap them?
It is dependent on the market of the fur at the time. So
it's all about fur? I mean, no one's trapping for food.
No one is trapping for food. I suppose you could, but I've never heard of it, at least in contemporary times. I think that the primary driver is the fur market in Asia, and that dictates what is done to the fur based on the market value. The secondary driver is the agricultural industry. And again, Michelle alluded to this, but livestock owners and ranchers perceive carnivores as a threat to cattle, and they perceive trapping as a means to protect their cattle, their livestock. And so that's kind of the secondary driver to this practice.
Yeah, the Trappers Association website says that they work in close association with cattlemen and ranchers, especially with the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. So how does that work? Are trappers paid by ranchers to trap predators?
Yep. Trappers can be paid by ranchers to kill predators that they, again, perceive correctly or incorrectly as a threat to their livestock. Trappers are employed by wildlife services as contractors to kill for wildlife services. And again, trappers are working for themselves for fur and pelt.
One of the things that I think is important for people to know, even though it's gruesome, is how traps work and how an animal dies and often doesn't die when it's trapped.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the hardest things to communicate to a public that often does not witness trap incidents firsthand, which makes it a difficult thing to change. But those few New Mexicans who have encountered trapping incidents see that these animals are largely caught by often a foothold trap and then left to struggle and gnaw their own appendages and bite these metal apparatuses, causing immense harm and damage to themselves, both physical and emotional, before they are eventually either able to set themselves free, often without a foot, or they're encountered by the trapper and they're killed in any means the trapper deems necessary.
And often they're not shot because that reduces the value of the animal. And so what, are they hit on the head?
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of different stories and mechanisms by which trappers kill the animals they have caught. And some of them are pretty gruesome. But like you said, the damage to the pelt is something that the trapper wants to avoid. So often, yeah, a shovel to the head, or I've heard of asphyxiation, all kinds of means to kill the animal without further damaging it.
Traps are, as you said, indiscriminate. Are animals getting trapped by mistake? I mean, other kinds of animals, dogs, and so on?
Absolutely. So just since December of 2017, every week until the end of trapping season, which was the middle of March, our coalition had at least one person in New Mexico report that their dog had been trapped while they were recreating on public lands. And that's just self-reporting. So there could be other people out there who are either uncomfortable reporting or don't know how to report who have also had their companion animals trapped. So it is a very, very frequent occurrence to have dogs trapped. And, you know, the incident with the cyanide bomb in Idaho was obviously an immense tragedy, but we are holding our breath hoping that a kid is not caught in a trap in New Mexico playing on public lands.
How do New Mexicans overall feel about trapping?
Polling indicates that the majority of New Mexicans do not want to see traps on public lands. So I think that's the key thing. But
a significant majority.
Yeah, a significant majority, over 2/3. I think another indicative thing is that the number of trappers, real active licensed trappers in the states, is probably something like 500 to 1,000. And if you think about that number compared to the state's population as a whole, or compared to people who are using public lands for any other reason who are facing those traps as a public safety hazard, I think what we see is kind of a tyranny of the minority, wherein the state is holding on to these regressive wildlife policies for the benefit of a tiny, tiny fraction of the population.
There's a tradition of cruelty in our country where animals are concerned, and a tradition of cruelty where people are concerned too, and I suspect those things are related. I mean, I was reading once a history of the seal trade and the way seals were clubbed to death by people who felt apparently no connection with them whatsoever. I mean, these are mammals, you know, who are looking at you. And a lot of these mammals, these seals, were in places where they hadn't really had any predators, so they would walk right up to them because they didn't have any fear. And they clubbed them to death by the hundreds on any given day, and they were simply commodities to them. And that, like, the difference in mindset between seeing an animal or seeing wildlife or seeing wild ecosystems or land as a commodity versus seeing it as something that you're part of. And we know that our, you know, Native brothers and sisters here in New Mexico certainly had a tradition of killing animals, but without that kind of like commodified cruelty. I mean, we're talking, when you talk about cultural changes, we're talking about really examining a part of our regional and national soul, which is very dark.
I think there's a lot to say about that and how our culture kind of emotes in terms of encountering wildlife. And I think that you're right in saying that there's kind of a dark area that we need to examine, which is a challenging thing. I also think that by and large, and economics plays this out, by and large, people want to experience wildlife living in our public lands, in our wild places. We want to be bird watchers, wildlife watchers, hikers, campers. And so, yes, I think that dark place exists, but I think the other side of that is that people do want to interact with these species in a more wholesome way.
I would agree. There's a lot of dark history with a number of environmental and social justice issues that we see in the news all the time. And I'm seeing a lot of hope in terms of the support from lots of diverse corners of North America and beyond, to think differently and to have policies that reflect these values that are increasingly more ethical, humane, and inclusive.
I think because we're living in such a politically tumultuous time, a lot of this stuff is coming to the surface. And I can't help but, I don't know if this is right or how you guys feel about it, but connect some of the real negative attitudes about gun violence, police shootings, the killings of animals. They seem to be all of a certain mentality that is probably a minority, but very vocal minority attitude in our country right now. And it's everywhere. It's coming out. You can't read a newspaper article without going to the comments section and finding a kind of deep, angry hostility that's almost like a hostility toward anyone but us or toward life itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in a number of issues, we see this us versus them mentality, and that applies to so many issues, not just wildlife. And that's something that we need to address, and with compassion towards all sides, I believe, because I think these people who are angry about issues are feeling a sense of loss over livelihood or access to resources that they used to have and no longer do. And so we just, I think, again, inclusion in a number of ways and compassion will help push the dialogue forward and get us to work together for progressive change.
Yeah, it's unlike me to play the role of optimist, but I do think that the outcomes of kind of this broad cultural examination that we're going through, you know, I think what we're seeing is we are going to hopefully for the better lose some of the kind of vestigial things that we've clung on to for centuries. And so My speculation is that when we ban trapping in New Mexico, that's not something that's going to come back again. I think we're progressing, and it's a struggle to progress, and it's painful to lose some of those things that we've clung on to for centuries. But I think when we come out the other side of these specific issues, I don't think we're going to look back, and certainly we'll encounter new issues that we need to face. But that's kind of my hope, is that this is the final stages of a struggle, in the case of trapping at least, and hopefully some of these broader issues, this is the final struggle that we won't have to face again in some ways.
Well, what kinds of legal and policy changes are you working on?
We, along with our allies, are trying to see through legislation that would ban trapping on public lands in New Mexico. Again, for the reasons I listed earlier, it's a public safety hazard, it's cruel, it's indiscriminate, it harms our native wildlife populations, and it's, you know, the privatization of our public wildlife. So we want to see that banned on public lands especially, and we're very optimistic that 2019 will see that happen.
What about you, Michelle? What kinds of legal and policy initiatives are you working on where Wildlife Services is concerned?
As I mentioned, we're working from the local to federal level. So right now we're focusing on supporting Pete DeFazio's House bill to ban those poisons that I was talking about earlier. And we're looking to get a Senate companion bill co-sponsored by Western Democrats. So that's a federal legislation that we're hoping to encourage our Western Dems to support. And then we're also working in coalition with local allies in a number of places on the county level to get these county contracts canceled.
How can people get involved if they want to find out more about these issues or get their voices heard?
They can contact their legislators. They can go on our website. For my work, there's endthewaronwildlife.org. All the information they would need for talking points to contact their legislators would be there, and they can sign up for emails and get involved and volunteer.
So wildearthguardians.org and endthewaronwildlife.org. Is there anything else that either of you wants to let us know?
Yeah, I want to quickly touch on, you know, the number of levels that Michelle just mentioned on which people can get involved, I think, is kind of the reaction to what you politely called our tumultuous political situation. And that's that activism is now happening on a municipal, a county, a state, and a federal level, and in even more localized community levels. So I think that that's, again, kind of a symptom of our times, but also really important for the work we're doing. And an example of that was that Albuquerque just unanimously adopted a resolution condemning coyote killing contests, which is a practice that is still legal in the state. So with that, you know, I think speaking to your city electeds, your county electeds, and your state electeds are all valuable to both of these causes. And for folks who want to learn more about trapping, I would visit wildearthguardians.org or trapfreenm.org.
Trapfreenm.org. Michelle Lute and Chris Smith are with Wild Earth Guardians. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.